This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The Syrian president praises Iran for supporting his country and the resistance front in the region as he pays a brief visit to Tehran. The Hamas resistance movement condemns the fatal shooting of three Palestinians by Israeli forces, saying the killings prove the regime is gripped by fear. Also, the group of seven leaders say they are committed to phase out or ban Russian oil imports as part of sanctions against Moscow over its war in Ukraine. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has hailed the Syrian nation for remaining steadfast during the years-long war in the Arab country. The leader was speaking with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad here in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei said Syria's victory in that war has brought it respect and credibility. He also spoke about relations between Tehran and Damascus, saying that both governments are determined to further expand cooperation. The Syrian president, for his part, praised Iran for supporting his country as well as the resistance front in the region. Al-Assad also held separate talks with his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. They discussed regional issues and bilateral relations. Raisi said the resistance of regional countries will result in a new order in West Asia. Al-Assad said Syria's ties with Iran are strategic. The one-day trip was Assad's second visit to Tehran since war broke out in Syria in 2011. Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, is with us from Sydney. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. I want you to tell us more about this strategic partnership between Tehran and Damascus, and also tell us how this, the close ties that exist between these two nations can help create a new order in West Asia.
Well, the alliance between Syria and Iran is extremely important. And you can see that by the amount of energy that the US and in particular Israel place on trying to damage it. All of the attacks, almost all of the attacks by the Israeli entity on bases in Syria, and there are hundreds of them, have a rationale that they're trying to attack Iranian bases in Syria. And so they're obsessed with the idea of Iran having a presence, having a strong alliance with other resistance players. Of course, Hezbollah in Lebanon, but in particular Syria, which is of course the key between Iran and Lebanon and the resistance in Lebanon. So it's very important alliance, and I'd like to draw to your viewers' attention that this is a 43-year-old alliance since the Iranian Revolution, despite the fact that they are very different systems. Syria is a pan-Arabist, supposedly secular system. Iran is a democracy based on the Quran. And yet, despite the fact of those different systems, it's rock-solid alliance. There hasn't been a budge in 43 years in that alliance. And that alliance is really largely a credit to the victory in Syria after all these years.
And they also, in the talks that were held between the Syrian president and the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, also the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, they talked of expanding cooperation and expanding the ties. So how do you predict the future of ties between these two nations?
Well, that's also very important because, as you would be aware, the economic war against Syria, in view of the failure of the mass terrorist war against Syria, is something that's having very damaging effects, not just in Syria, but in Lebanon, in other countries of the region, the blockades in Palestine and Yemen. These economic blockades are spreading around the world. Of course, they're in Latin America, they're in parts of Africa, and parts of Asia. And so the restructuring of economic relations is very important from the Syrian point of view and from the Iranian point of view. And of course, the strategic partnership between Iran and China is very important. The relationships with Russia have become more important. And the integration of the entire West Asian region and the restructuring of new channels of finance are particularly important to all of the countries that have been attacked by Washington using its tool of the US dollar and the SWIFT system. And I think with the attacks on Russia recently, that new financial architecture is coming closer.
Tim Anderson, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. A pleasure to have you on Press TV. Tim Anderson, the director for Center of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Sydney. Moving on. Iran says a visit by the EU Deputy Foreign Policy Chief to Tehran will put the talks for the revival of the 2015 agreement on the right path. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Enrique Mora's upcoming visit will focus on the proposals made by the EU foreign policy chief during his recent phone call with the Iranian foreign minister. Khatibzadeh stressed that the visit is part of the ongoing process of exchange of messages between Iran and the P4+1 as part of the Vienna talks. He said Iran and the group have been committed to a good and reliable agreement despite anti-diplomatic moves by the U.S. Congress. He said Iran is ready for an agreement as part of the Vienna talks immediately if Washington accepts the Iranian nation's rights. Israel pushes ahead with its atrocities against Palestinians. The regime's forces have killed three more Palestinians in three separate attacks across the occupied West Bank. One victim, Mahmoud Sami Aram, succumbed to his wounds after being shot near the city of Tul Karim. The Israeli army claimed he was trying to cross a barrier separating the occupied territories. Another Palestinian was killed in Al-Quds over the allegation that he tried to stab an Israeli officer. And the third person was shot dead in a settlement near Bethlehem. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the killing, saying they revealed the regime is gripped by fear. Separately, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned Israeli crimes in the occupied land. Tel Aviv has intensified raids and bloody crackdown following Palestinian operations in recent weeks that left over a dozen Israelis dead.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subhi Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in northern-occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
It's one form of the collective punishment adopted by the Israeli regime. They think these punishments will stop Palestinians or prevent their operations. Israel knows very well it has failed to prevent such operations, and we can see that the Palestinian resistance continues and even has gained momentum.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Lebanese citizens living abroad cast their ballots in the country's parliamentary election. Around 200,000 Lebanese expatriates in 48 countries are eligible to vote. On Friday, those living in Iran and several Arab countries cast their ballots in their diplomatic missions. The ballot boxes will be sent to Lebanon and stored at a central bank before being counted on Election Day. On May the 15th, voters inside Lebanon will head to the polls. The elections come amid an unprecedented economic crisis that began in 2019, leading to the currency collapse and plunging over 70% of the population into poverty. In the last election held in 2018, the Hezbollah resistance movement and its allies won majority seats. The Hezbollah chief blames the crisis on a U.S.-led conspiracy against his country. The United States and its allies impose more sanctions on Russia in response to the war in Ukraine. The leaders of the Group of Seven industrialized nations say they will move to phase out or ban the import of Russian oil. They pledge to reinforce Russia's economic isolation and elevate a campaign against Russian elites who support Putin. That's why members such as Resource Poor Japan depend heavily on Russian fuel. Tokyo says it will take time to phase out Russian oil imports. Russia was Japan's fifth biggest supplier of crude oil and LNG last year, but there have been no ships loading Russian oil for Japan in the last 3 weeks. Meanwhile, the European Union says it's getting closer to agreeing tough sanctions against Russia that include a ban on oil purchase. The bloc has scheduled more talks for Monday to work out how to ensure countries most dependent on Russian energy can cope. Those countries include Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. Also, the U.S. has unveiled new sanctions against three Russian television stations and executives from Gazprom Bank. Washington has also banned Americans from providing accounting and consulting services to Russians. Russia is celebrating Victory Day, an annual event to mark the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. The occasion takes on new importance for Russia because of its war in Ukraine, with President Vladimir Putin vowing, quote, as in 1945, victory will be ours. Ahead of the event, the Russian leader said Ukraine is in the grip of fascism and that Nazism is rearing its head once more. He called it a sacred duty to take revenge on successors of those who were defeated decades ago. He, however, wished all Ukrainians a peaceful and just future. Russia has repeatedly insisted that its military offensive in Ukraine, launched on February the 24th, is to demilitarize and denazify its neighbor. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says his country would support Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Ukrainians will not accept this, and neither will we. Rarely have we stood as united with our friends and partners as we do today. I am deeply convinced that Putin will not win the war. Ukraine will persist. Freedom and security will triumph, just as freedom and security triumphed over a lack of freedom, violence, and dictatorship 77 years ago.
Scholz said the outcome of the war would not be a Russian-dictated peace in Ukraine. He claimed Putin wants to subjugate Ukraine, destroy its culture and identity. He also accused the Russian leader of distorting history by, quote, equating his barbaric war of aggression with a fight against national socialism. He said Germany has sent a large cache of weapons to Ukraine to help it fight against Russia. Ukrainian forces trapped inside a steel plant in the now Russia-controlled city of Mariupol say they will not surrender, vowing to fight on. A top Ukrainian officer says the troops have limited supplies but enough munitions to respond, adding that surrender is not an option. He said they have witnessed war crimes committed by Russian forces in the port city. He added the Ukrainian forces will not abandon their injured colleagues. The steel plant is the last pocket of Ukrainian resistance in the city. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said 60 people were killed in the Russian bombing of a school in the country's east. According to Ukrainian officials, the school sheltering about 90 people was hit on Saturday, causing a fire that engulfed the building. Sweden and Finland are expected to announce their bid to officially apply to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, also known as NATO. The move has infuriated Moscow and could see the Baltic region become much more militarized. Robert Carter explores whether the move would actually benefit Sweden and Finland at all in the following report.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality, as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Voting is underway in the Philippines to elect a new president. More than 65 million Filipinos are eligible to cast their ballots. 10 candidates are vying to succeed incumbent Rodrigo Duterte. But only Marcos Jr., the son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, and his rival Lenny Robredo, the incumbent vice president, are seen as the top contenders. Pre-election surveys show Marcos Jr. is heading for a landslide as voter turnout is expected to be high. More than 60,000 security forces have been deployed to protect ballots and election workers. Polls open at 6 a.m. local time on Monday and will continue until 7 p.m. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.nato.org/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. Meanwhile, the U.S. public has witnessed and experienced an unfathomable amount of death and tragedy over the course of the pandemic. U.S. billionaires have made out like kings and massively increased their wealth over the course of just over 2 years, new data shows. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As Over a Million Have Died of COVID, U.S. Billionaires Have Gained $1.7 Trillion. Here's more. While the U.S. public has witnessed and experienced an unfathomable amount of death and tragedy over the course of the pandemic, U.S. billionaires have made out like kings and massively increased their wealth over the course of just 2 years, new data shows. According to an analysis by the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, American billionaires have added a colossal $1.71 trillion to their wealth since March 2020. With an over 58% growth in their wealth, U.S. billionaires are now worth a collective $4.67 trillion. This is a towering figure. It amounts to nearly 25% of the U.S. GDP, $19.74 trillion, split between 727 people. The $1.71 trillion that billionaires have accumulated over a pandemic could pay for the entirety of the Build Back Better Act, Congressional Democrats' reconciliation bill that was slated to implement President Joe Biden's social safety net and climate program last year. Alternatively, their wealth gain alone could pay off nearly all student loans, which are burdening 45 million Americans. IPS's report comes as the U.S. has hit 1 million deaths due to COVID-19. According to an NBC analysis, though the real death toll is likely higher. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, a large portion of COVID deaths were uncounted, meaning the total could be closer to 1.29 million deaths or more. When 100,000 people had died due to COVID in May 2020, the New York Times labeled the milestone as incalculable. 10 times that amount represents a loss beyond words. But perhaps not for billionaires, especially those who have seen their wealth skyrocket over the past 2 years. Elon Musk's wealth multiplied by over 10 times during the pandemic. In March 2020, he was worth $24.6 billion, an already huge amount for any individual. And he's worth $255 billion and is the richest person in the world among those whose net worth is publicly available. Omar Ocampo, a co-author of IPS report, told reporters, "This jarring juxtaposition clearly illustrates that the work and strength of the working class have made U.S. billionaires wealthier, yet continue to bear the brunt of the pandemic. A strengthened labor movement and progressive taxation are both necessary to strengthen workers' rights and make available to us the resources needed to increase investment in our healthcare system," unquote. Others who were already shockingly wealthy also accumulated even more money during the pandemic. Jeff Bezos' wealth shot up by nearly a third, from $113 billion to $150 billion. Bill Gates also gained about a third of his previous net worth, with his wealth growing from $98 billion to $130 billion. Three members of the Watson family who control more than 50% of Walmart, have seen their collective wealth grow by about 27% to $207.7 billion.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly programme that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's maiden visit to India as part of efforts to draw the country closer to the West and away from Russia. And we shall also take a look at the deteriorating security situation in Afghanistan in the wake of the resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group with overt and covert backing of Western spy agencies.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's long-delayed visit to India in March was overshadowed by his controversial visit to a JCB factory in Gujarat, but the main agenda of his maiden visit was clear: to woo New Delhi with an attractive defence partnership and wean the country off its reliance on Russian arms as the war in Ukraine rages on. While the offer of defence collaboration was not entirely snubbed, New Delhi made it amply clear that it was very unlikely to abandon its long-lasting ties with Russia.
British Premier Boris Johnson dashed off to India in the third week of April to entice the Narendra Modi-led government in New Delhi with a bag full of offers. The timing of the visit was interesting. In the middle of the war in Ukraine and with the UK and other Western powers mounting pressure on Russia to end its military operation in the former Soviet Republic. For Johnson, the task was cut out. It was to persuade New Delhi to recalibrate its position on the raging war in Ukraine in lieu of defense exports and expertise in building its own military equipment. Johnson told Modi that the UK would streamline licensing rules to export defense equipment to India. That's the first time this facility has been extended to a country outside the European Union and the US. He also offered to transfer advanced technology to produce fighter jets in India and support India's maritime technology needs. While India welcomed closer defense collaboration with its former colonizer, it unequivocally conveyed to the visiting official that New Delhi's bond with Moscow was unbreakable. Plus, military analysts are of the opinion that the move designed to draw India closer to the West is bound to fail, as Moscow remains a one-stop shop for India's military needs due to unrestricted tech transfers, price, and suitability.
Johnson's first visit to India came amid raging war in Ukraine, where New Delhi is seen batting on Moscow's side. As a country overwhelmingly dependent on Russian arms, India has refused to join Western countries, including the UK, in condemning Russia's military operation in Ukraine. To coax India to change its stance, many top Western officials have made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent weeks, but almost all of them have returned red-faced, Johnson being the latest.
As a country overwhelmingly dependent on Russian arms, India has understandably refused to join hands with Western countries, including its Quad partners, in condemning Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Top Indian officials have maintained that the country's position on the Ukraine war is driven by national and strategic interests. Even Johnson acknowledged it after he met with Prime Minister Modi in New Delhi, saying he agrees with India's position on Ukraine, as the South Asian country shares a historic relationship with Russia that everybody understands and respects. The remark suggested that the British Premier reluctantly swallowed a bitter pill. India has shared time-tested defense ties with Russia and relies on it for nearly half of its imported military equipment, despite tensions with Russia's close regional ally, China, and in the face of pressure from Western countries that have scores to settle with Moscow. While the government in New Delhi has called for an end to the war in Ukraine, it has been unwilling to take a hard-nosed position against its Cold War ally. Johnson had hoped to change that equation with his security offers, as well as a free trade deal, but experts stress that dislodging Russia as the top defense partner remains an uphill task.
Now, to have more insight, we have invited Mrs. Naeemeh Mahjoor, columnist at Independent Urdu, to the program. Now, Mrs. Mahjoor, let's begin with the British Prime Minister's recent visit to India. Boris Johnson said his country would expedite defence exports to India and also provide expertise in building India's own fighter jets. Now, how significant do you think this is?
Well, this visit of Boris Johnson was long overdue, but, you know, due to COVID pandemic, this visit was delayed. And I think it has a lot of significance at the moment, keeping in view the changing world scenario when there's a huge debate going on between East and the West, the waning power of US, the Russian-Ukraine war, and the sides taken by those countries which West particularly wants to take a clear stand, and India is one of them. I think the West is again asking neutral countries to take open stand against Russia, like, you know, it imposed its policy of either be with us or against us on Taliban after 9/11 attacks. In the past weeks, we have seen many visits of top American officials to India. Boris Johnson's visit can also be counted as an extension of U.S. diplomacy and make India to support it in return for many trade and military deals. The joint statement you might have seen, which was issued after Boris Johnson's visit, explains it all and also gives indication that Western countries can go much beyond the earlier restrictions on sharing defense technology with India.
Mr. Mahjoor, so Johnson's visit to New Delhi came amidst raging war in Ukraine and India's refusal to align with Western powers against Russia. So why is the West so hell-bent on persuading India to recalibrate its position on Ukraine?
Despite internal issues of human rights violations against minorities in India, the Western democracies still count India as the largest democracy in the world. India is also considered the only country in Asia to counter China's growing influence and economic landscape in the world. The stand taken by India would matter for Russia, which has a 1 billion market at its disposal. And then the image of NATO countries has become dented since few decades. The debacle in Afghanistan has humiliated it. And then Russia's coming closer to Taliban. India is considered one of the biggest and emerging markets in the world, which capitalists wouldn't afford to leave it unexploited. And the most important thing, Russia's defense industry has India as the biggest buyer in the world. As long as both India and Russia keep this commitment of buying and sharing defense deals, Moscow might not get a hit as US wants it to get hit after this Ukraine war if India keeps supporting Russia. Amid this whole scenario, I think the UK PM's visit has this intent of persuading India to break this commitment with Russia so as to become a partner in New World Order and get too much in return for it.
Mr. Maju, we know that India and Russia share long-standing defence ties, and New Delhi continues to rely on Moscow for nearly half of its imported military equipment. Now, is it safe to argue that India won't go against its national and strategic interests to please Western allies?
Not only defence deals or military hardware or knowledge-sharing agreements are India's national or strategic policies, but Moscow has always proved a rock-solid support for India, be it veto in UN on Kashmir or stand against Pakistan. The only issue which has become a point of concern among Indian defense circles at the moment while watching Ukraine war is, can Russian military hardware meet Indian demands, or can it sustain attacks from its enemies like China or Pakistan in future? The Ukraine war has proved Russian war machinery not up to the mark or matching to NATO countries. So I think India may not leave Russia, but will certainly upgrade its defense equipment with the defense deals with the UK and other NATO countries. And UK has already promised India to share its latest technology, and we have to wait for it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mahju from London for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
David Lammy, a Labour Party MP, says Prime Minister Boris Johnson is scared of briefing the British Parliament on his fruitless trip to India, which shows the trip was meant to distract attention from scandals at home. Independent journalist and commentator Sunny Hundal blasts Boris Johnson for visiting India in the middle of the Ukraine war, noting that India is far more pro-Russia than many in the West actually realize. Bruce McDee, a political blogger and activist, says Johnson's justification of visiting India in a failed attempt to change the lies agenda at home was to shift India's position on Ukraine, in which he failed completely.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
A spate of deadly terror attacks has rocked Afghanistan in recent weeks, sending ripples of fear and panic across the country and challenging the rulers in Kabul barely 8 months after the botched exit of US-led allied forces. What's remarkable is the consistent pattern of these attacks, the same set of perpetrators and victims. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has managed to regain a foothold in the crisis-stricken country with the overt and covert support of foreign spy agencies.
The holy month of Ramadan was again marked by violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, where the Daesh terrorist group has made a comeback in parallel with the Taliban's dramatic takeover. A string of explosions ripped through schools, mosques, buses and markets in major cities such as Kabul, Mazar-Sharif and Kunduz in recent weeks, leaving scores dead. Most of these attacks targeted members of the minority Hazara Shia community, which has a history of persecution. Daesh proudly claimed responsibility for the carnage, further destabilizing the nation that is already grappling with the worst economic and humanitarian crisis. However, what has got security analysts thinking is the ease and ferocity with which the terrorist group has been able to carry out recent strikes, which evidently points to the hand of Western spy agencies that have shared goals with Daesh now. Notably, in the months leading to the US ouster from Afghanistan, thousands of terrorists made their way into the country and were recruited by Daesh. What is also notable is these foreign terrorists infiltrated the country under the nose of US-led allied forces. There is a popular belief that Daesh and Western spy agencies are hand in glove in destabilizing the country to undermine the Taliban rule and manufacture a pretext to invade the country again.
The latest spell of violence in the crisis-hit South Asian country and the resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban rulers, who continue to insist that the group has been wiped away from the country. While it's becoming increasingly clear that the terrorist group is playing the role of proxy for Americans in Afghanistan, pressure is mounting on the new rulers in Kabul to put an end to violence and ensure the safety and security of vulnerable ethnic minorities.
The country lying at the crossroads of South and Central Asia is again finding itself in the grip of foreign-backed terrorism after 20 years of foreign military occupation. Having been humiliated and thrown out of the war-ravaged country, foreign powers have now found a new ally in Daesh to execute their nefarious designs in the country. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi recently pointed to this fact by holding Western spy services responsible for violence in Afghanistan. President Raisi also called on the Taliban to get its act together and protect the lives of all Afghans, including religious minorities. There seems to be a consensus on the fact that the buck stops at the current rulers in Kabul. The responsibility of protecting the citizens of Afghanistan and eliminating all forms of terrorism lies with the Taliban. While Daesh sees the Taliban as an irreconcilable enemy that needs to be militarily defeated, the Taliban sees Daesh as an evil force that has no place in Afghanistan. It is incumbent on the Taliban to eliminate the new threat posed by Daesh and its foreign backers, and it's also important for the group to form an inclusive government, which can pave the way for peace and stability in the country.
Now to shed more light, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyai, author at Covert Action magazine. So glad to have you again on the program, sir. Now, Afghanistan has been rocked by a string of deadly explosions in recent weeks, mostly targeting minority Hazara Shias. What do perpetrators seek from attacking schools and mosques in the holy month of Ramadan?
Right. Unfortunately, we have been witnessing a cascade of terrorist attacks for the last couple of weeks in Afghanistan. And this is part and parcel of another greater project whereby, certain forces are trying to stoke more violence in the country and thereby creating more instability in Afghanistan. And it is, of course, very suspicious that this, the timing of it, of course, one would expect that during the holy month of Ramadan, an attack like that, an inhumane attack like that, should actually never happen, but certainly not during a holy month like that, whereby unknown number of innocent civilians are being killed. And so one cannot merely call this sectarian violence anymore. There are reasonable voices that who would even plead that everything that is happening in the country or has been happening for the last two decades actually signifies something much greater than sectarian violence, namely genocide. Over and over again, we have seen how the Shiite minority in Afghanistan, but also the, as of recently, we have seen attacks orchestrated against Sufi groups in the country, and whereby an attack was orchestrated against a group of Sufis while they were praying or in their place of worship, which was in Dar Lamon, which is located roughly 2 kilometers from the capital, Kabul. And that attack culminated in the death of at least 300 innocent civilians. So, and this this kind of violence, unfortunately, goes back 20 years ago when Afghanistan had a Western-backed corrupt government. And in that, you know, under the reign of both Karzai and Ahmadzai, and with their entire entourage of political supporters, which included also many leaders or political leaders from different religious groups and ethnic groups, but they were unfortunately all involved in a situation where they were more preoccupied with their own personal gainings rather than taking care of collective interests, that of the Afghan people.
Mr. Ariyari, Daesh claimed responsibility for the terrorist attacks, even though Taliban officials insist that the group has already been wiped out from the country. Now, do you see a sinister game being played by foreign powers to destabilize the country?
Absolutely. I mean, it was pretty much wishful thinking by a lot of people when they saw the Americans or the Western powers leaving Afghanistan, and a lot of people were thinking, oh, this is probably the end. But I would say this is only the beginning of the end. Of course, the foreign powers, they didn't just leave Afghanistan. Of course, there was a power vacuum when they left the country and the Taliban took it over. And it was some kind of a very, almost an ideal situation where you had the United States, you know, the occupiers leaving the country, and they were indeed occupiers. But it was not that they left the country without a strategy, or they just left the country with, well, okay, we lost the war and that's it. No, they have a long-term strategy for the entire region, which includes Afghanistan, but also the broader region, Central Asia. And it's this brings us back to a historical time span where there was a great power rivalry between Tsaristic Russia and the great British Empire, and that was coined as the Great Game. But for many Afghans, this Great Game has never really stopped. And there are very sinister plans involved, unfortunately, because there are still many CIA officials operating in Afghanistan. And so the West certainly does have a stake in that part of the region, and Afghanistan, unfortunately, happens to be a part of that.
Now, many reports suggest that Daesh Takfiris have regained foothold in the war-ravaged country with the patronage of Western spy agencies to undermine Taliban government and to foment civil war. Now, what's your take on this?
Well, unfortunately, the Taliban government doesn't have that much of a support inside the country. And I think that both Daesh and Taliban, from an ideological point of view, are pretty much related to one another. They're both adhering to a very hardcore branch of Hanafi-style government, where there is no place for pluralism. And of course, the Daesh, you know, divide and rule, that is still the prevailing rule by foreign powers, and how to, in terms of how to meddle in a country that is not much of their liking. and Afghanistan is certainly it is an epicenter of that in Central Asia, where they really try to make Afghanistan once again a safe haven for terrorism. The end goal, of course, would be the destabilization of Afghanistan and with it Central Asia, and that forms an existential threat to a lot of neighboring countries, but also regional powers like Iran, and of course great powers like China, Russia. So yes, there are many very, very dark plans involved, unfortunately, and outside powers, they have a great stake in that. And the Taliban is a symptom of that, but you know, one could easily think of Daesh, because even there were even reports back, you know, years ago where the Afghan Defense Ministry actively took part in replacing Daesh elements from the south of Afghanistan to the north. So it was a long-standing plan already, and it comes into fruition now. And Daesh, unfortunately, they already had a hold in Afghanistan.
There you have it, Mr. Ariyai, author at COVID Action magazine from the Netherlands. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Qom seminary scholar and multimedia producer Sheikh Muzaffar Abbas cites the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, back in 2018, warning of the U.S. relocating Daesh terrorists from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. Hadi Nasrallah, a political analyst and writer, says the recent string of terror attacks in Afghanistan bears the hallmark of the U.S. spy agency, which is using its proxy Daesh to stoke civil war in Central Asia. Filmmaker and writer Richard Woolley states that Al-Qaeda has always been America's proxy force in the region, who together with the Daesh terrorist group carry out the amoral and devious mission of the U.S.
And that was our episode about Western efforts to woo India with attractive defense cooperation offers to push it away from Russia. And also how Daesh and foreign backers are hell-bent on destabilizing Afghanistan and stoking civil war and sectarian divide in the country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight. Anxiety is never going to be fun, but it can be healthy. And facing up to it is always better than hiding. We have prepared for you an article written by Kate Smith. The piece is titled, Anxiety Can Be Good For You. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari was a professor of psychology immersed in research, evaluating which mental health treatments worked and why, when she first became aware of an uptick in anxiety. This was some 15 years ago in New York City. She says, I worked closely with practicing clinicians, and I remember one of them saying, I'm seeing all these parents and kids coming in, and they're talking about anxiety the way we used to talk about stress. She added, everything is about anxiety. Back then, Dr. Dennis Tiwari believed treatments would make a difference. She says, I thought we were going to claw this back, but the opposite happened. Instead, that uptick became an avalanche. Today, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health issue in the United States, affecting 30% of adults. In Britain, prescriptions for anti-anxiety medications have almost doubled over the past 15 years, with a sharp rise among the under-25s. In the US, prescriptions have quadrupled. In 2021, a survey of 8,000 children led Oxford University Press to name anxiety as the word of the year. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, "It's the word on everyone's lips, the challenge of the moment. We have configured ourselves to think of ourselves as an anxious society. We have a million great self-help books, scientifically validated treatments. We have 30 different anti-anxiety medications, but the field has not kept pace with the treatment and prevention of physical disease. None of it is sticking." She notes, "I was part of the problem, however well-intentioned, until I started to wake up about a decade ago and began thinking, wait a second, what are we saying to people? The idea that anxiety is something to manage or eradicate, a habit to be broken, is wrong and actually doing us harm. It's literally a recipe for more anxiety." This is the central message in Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari's new book, Future Tense. She concludes that the problem isn't anxiety itself, but our beliefs about it and our attempts to avoid it, which are not only destined to fail, but also to make us weaker, more fragile. It's a vicious cycle. Help reframe anxiety as an ally and not an enemy, Future Tense takes a deep dive into the emotion itself. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, "Anxiety is very different to fear. Fear is the certainty that something bad is happening to you. Anxiety is about uncertainty. It's the feeling that something bad could happen, but might